Hey there everybody, this is Catherine Mary, and just before we start smooth styling their bits today, I just wanted to say thank you to everyone who said such nice things about the first mini-sode that I managed to get out last week. Today's the first real one, but your kind comments and excitement about the future really mean a lot to me, so thank you very much, and enjoy the show. She's talking about some funny things that have her all in fits. She's ranting about the subjects that get right on her tits. She's chatting with the lovely folk and some who are real shits. It's smooth style, no bits. Smooth style, no bits. It's a podcast. Well, hey there, pretty people. This is Catherine Mary welcoming you to another episode of Smooth Style, No Bits. I went to a pantomime this week. I must say, I wasn't thrilled. I love pantomimes. Oh my God, I love them. My dear mother was an actress, and one amongst many plays I saw her in when I was a child, the pantomimes have some of the most fantastic memories. They were twinkly and sparkly and exciting and thrilling and magical. And then I also got to go backstage and try on the costumes and see the pumpkin coach and stroke the Shetland ponies, and I completely loved it. Of course, the first reason I didn't enjoy it was because it wasn't really a panto. They call them Christmas stories with songs or something these days, apparently because they can't really afford to put on, you know, proper pantomimes. But if it's Christmas, it's a panto, guys. You've got to get your head around it. The audience laughed 1.5 times in the whole show. I don't just mean me. I mean the entire audience, which included brownies and all the kids that I was with and all the grown-ups and everybody. 1.5 times. Even if you're not calling it a panto, there's got to be more laughs than that, surely. And I have to say that everybody's terribly, terribly nice accents until the evil mice arrived.
Well, of course, they talked like that, didn't they? They was cockney evil mice.
Thereby once again reaffirming the class divisions that are set between us. Yeah, smash it. I'm working mainly on the patriarchy at the moment, but I'll do the class system as well when I've got a minute. Christmas feels, though, are strong with me. I've had 3 posties in one day today. Incredible. 2 men and a woman, all of whom are wearing those rather nice orange fluorescent jackets that the Royal Mail seem to be issuing at the moment. I like them. I'm also delighted to say that the first nativity scene I saw recently was knitted. Oh, I love a knitted nativity scene. Especially the wonky ones. The ones with the faces where the sheep are all a bit lopsided and have got a bad leg, and Mary and Joseph are perhaps got little arms stretched out, and baby Jesus is wrapped up in thread in a manger made of matchsticks. Everybody in the scene that I saw was white, which, as we know, simply is not accurate nor presenting a balanced picture of modern society. So either way you look at it, that's a pile of poo, isn't it? I also treated myself to a copy of the Christmas Radio Times, the TV guide for the festive period. And at some point I'm going to sit down with a lovely cup of tea and a biro, or perhaps a highlighter pen, or a selection of highlighter pens, and mark up some television treats. But there's something about watching them live, isn't there? I will be there at 7:30 p.m. on Christmas Day watching Doctor Who. And if you don't want to watch it with me, I don't care. But you will shut up and not talk all the way through. And of course, as I believe I've mentioned before, we will not be missing Pemberley on Boxing Day because my brother's in it. On to my first interview. I'm delighted to introduce to you my dear friend and musical buddy, Colin McAllister. We talked a little bit about how we met, how we came to start and continue to play with this enormous multi-headed beast called the Southampton Ukulele Jam. It was interesting as well to reflect a little bit on why it's had the success it's had and continues to have, which was great. It was lovely as well to talk to Colin more about his life before I knew him. I always enjoy talking to people about their happy childhoods. I didn't have one, and I find them fascinating and mysterious. I have to remember that people's experience was was not the same as mine. And so connections that you make, particularly with people that you become close to in your life, there's a bit that we don't share. And that's kind of interesting to me. It was also funny to find out that despite the best efforts of the man, he never managed to live or work in Scotland after he was kind of obliged to leave to do an acting course that he wanted to pursue. And it seemed like he struggled really hard. He kept applying, but they wouldn't have him back. But we're really pleased, because if he hadn't landed down here on the south coast of the UK, I would never have met him and he wouldn't be my buddy. So finally, before I move over to that interview, just to say apologies for some of the banging and clunking you'll hear in the interview. I'm learning, all right? The big clunk is a cup of coffee on the desk. There is also squeaky chair at one point, if you listen out for it, and what I'm calling phone bing. There's also a moment where the whole thing grinds to a halt and I had to click some buttons to get it started again. But I left it in because, hey, trying to keep it real. Hopefully, as I get better at this, you won't have to listen to that so much. But hey, it's the talking that counts. So anyway, here it is, talking to Colin. Enjoy. So hello, Colin McAllister. Thank you very much for being my first guest on my podcast.
It's a privilege. Thank you very much for
inviting me. It feels very strange to be talking to you in this situation because you are something of a brother to me.
Yeah.
Mr. McAllister, so asking you questions like I don't know who you are is a bit strange. So I'm not going to do that. I'm going to find out the bits that I don't know.
The bits in between.
I thought. So I have known you for maybe 6 years.
Yeah, 2008 properly.
Oh, wow. 2008.
Well,
and do you want to tell the story of how we met? Go on, you tell it.
Well, actually, I'm not entirely sure. You might be able to fill in some of my gaps.
Okay.
So I think I posted maybe on bitternpark.info and portswood.info, maybe, that I was a ukulele player and I was looking for other ukulele players to play with. And I had met a couple of people, nice, really nice people, who'd come round to my house and we'd played songs and that had been fine, but it never stuck. And then I think you must have sent me an email or something. And we both recognised that we both played the ukulele and we met in the Talking Heads pub one night. And I don't think we'd really met before then.
No, we hadn't met. No, it was a complete blind ukulele date. We turned up and I had no idea. I hadn't even spoken to you.
Hmm.
So when you opened your mouth and you were a Scot, that was like, ooh!
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
It was less surprising
in that area.
Yeah.
And we sat there and I brought my ukulele and you went, oh, we're going to play.
Yes.
And I was thinking, oh, thank fuck, because maybe we're not going to play. That's good. I'd really kind of boasted myself that maybe I was going to have to play. I was going to have to, you know, expose myself in that kind of way. But we didn't.
No. And so what was going on in my head at that point was that, I mean, and even still, we at the Ukulele Jam played a gig yesterday, and I still play maybe only 2/3 of the chords that I'm supposed to play.
Yeah.
We're
not very good players.
People ask me for advice and stuff, and I don't really know. I know how to play
Did I tell you I went to see Billy Bragg in concert the other day, and he was talking about his son asking him to show him how to play this lead part for a song, and him having to very bashfully say, I'm not that sort of guitar player.
No, I can only play what I know.
And I thought, great, if Billy Bragg's not that sort of guitar player, I don't have to be that sort of ukulele player. I've always felt a bit ashamed that I don't play better than I do.
And so I had willfully not brought my ukulele because I didn't want you to say, well, play me a song then. I don't think I even could have played a song at that point.
Who had you played with in your kitchen?
There was two guys, one guy that I can't even remember, but I had to play. With those people.
Oh, so it was a bit like seeing one of those notices in a music shop, drummer wanted for band.
Yeah, a bit like that.
Terrifying.
Yes.
You could have ended up in the Spice Girls.
Anything could have happened.
Yeah.
He said that I had a nice voice, which I don't know. I don't know.
You went, my voice in the other room.
There was another guy who is a carer. A carer of a disabled man in Southampton.
Yes, he did come. He did. Yeah. He did used to come to the big.
If he's still out there, he's changed his email address 5,000 times in the course of 2 weeks, and so I lost track of which one it was. So if you are listening to it, nice person, I'm still here.
Yeah, get in touch.
And you know where they're talking heads every 2 weeks. So
well, and we should explain what this thing is. Colin and I met in this meeting in this pub and said, okay, we've both been playing on our own forever and a day. Let's see if there's anybody else out there. And my God, was there anybody else?
Yeah, but that was the joy of you doing it, because I had no idea, and you just kind of went, okay, well then we'll just do it. And I went, oh, all right, then that's fine. And I don't know how those 17 people turned up on the first night, but 17 people turned up.
It was mainly the local websites that Guy runs, who maybe you'll meet in another podcast. I think maybe I put some posters up in some places. I can get very diverted into designing things that is unnecessary, you know, make a mountain out of a molehill. But I probably made some very fancy posters for things. And then, yeah, and then people started emailing me. And the first one was Alex Muck. Forgive me, Alex, I can't remember your name, who works with Ray Monk, who we now know very well.
Yes.
And he said, how's about this song? And he emailed to me that tune, which is...
Are you about to...
I'll See You in My Dreams, is it?
Oh, right, okay, yeah.
It's the George Harrison
connected song. I'll See You in My Dreams, yeah, it is. I'll See You in My Dreams.
Well, it's always interesting, isn't it, when you start playing with people or you meet people, because the songs they want to play... You suddenly go, oh, I see. Oh, you want to play that, do you?
Yes.
Oh, that's not really kind of what I had in mind. But I think also you and I were very like-minded about the sorts of things we were interested in playing.
Yeah.
Which was probably another part of the spark that got it going. Yeah,
And I still have some of those problems. But now the management of the ukulele jam, which is a marvellous thing, but the management of what's... songs we're going to play and the definite lack of control that we all want to have, but then of course being controlling, well, certainly as far as I'm concerned, quite a controlling person, there's a real friction between those two things, and ending up playing Delilah, you know, Tom Jones' Delilah, or Hi Ho Silver Lining, songs that I really don't have any desire to play or any. But then you turn out, and if you're doing a gig and people are singing along and waving
massive
their arms,
massive crowd pleases.
So then you've got other reasons to play songs, not just for your own sense of well-being or what you want to play musically, but actually you're involved in a conversation with an audience, and so you've got to play stuff that they want to hear as well.
Well, the other thing that happened that first night after we hadn't realised this, I don't think at all, but the pub's open mic night was the same night as Monday that we met. The Candle Club at the Talking Head said, do you want to get up and play? So the very first night we met, we got up and played on stage as a band, and suddenly, rock and roll, it was all happening. And that sort of hugely cemented this thing, and suddenly it existed.
Yeah.
This is six Christmas cabarets now, or
on,
five?
The Sunday week tonight is our sixth.
Before we talk about that, and before we divert off into things that you're doing with other people, I want to talk about you, because I have become very interested in the fortunes of Ayr United Football Club recently.
Man.
Yeah, very, very interested. Your kit's not great, boys. I want to talk to you about your outfits. But apart from that, I think, you know, I'm looking at the international boys, I'm looking at your Barcelonas, I'm looking to Brazil, I'm looking at the national squads and saying, come on, boys, you can brighten things up a bit. But that's just another matter.
It's black and white is the black and white. Very quickly, so we were having our house painted white, and I suggested that I'd like to have all the woodwork around the windows and the door painted black, and the person who was painting our house said, why on earth, that'll look awful. And I was absolutely confused about it, and it happened and it wasn't until I drove back into the west coast of Scotland where you suddenly realise that every house that's painted white has got black around the windows. And it's that's one of the standard ways to paint your house in the west. And I hadn't realised that. And then you link that with the fact that United Football Club play in black and white, and it suddenly becomes
a
fitting thing. So I can't help you with the colours.
Well, I've never really had an allegiance to any football team apart from Norwich, because my son supports Norwich,
nice,
so I take a little interest in them,
yellow,
and they've got a little dicky bird and all, that's quite cute. So I'm taking a bit of an interest in there. So I'm interested in this place where you're trying to lure me up there come the summer.
Yeah, if we get into the playoffs, we're going on a big trip up.
Tell me about that. So where is Ayr? But place it in Scotland for me.
Yeah, okay. Ayr is southwest of Glasgow, on the coast. So if you can imagine the Mull of Kintyre that comes down like a funny little nose pointing towards Northern Ireland, then there's a gap in between them. I'm really good at geography. In between the Mull of Kintyre.
Your hands are doing a fantastic... So, I should take some pictures.
The Firth of Clyde goes up with the Mull of Kintyre on your left, and then Ayres on your right-hand side. So Mull of Kintyre comes down. There's a beautiful island called Arran in the middle.
Oh, beautiful.
And then Ayres on the coast there.
So when you say on the coast, what...
It's a fishing village.
Oh, okay.
A fishing town. A town. It was a fishing town. It has no fishing fleet anymore.
So is it quite an industrial place? Or is there seaside? Is it...
It was the place that people from Glasgow went on their holidays.
Ah.
Before they went on package holidays. Genuinely. There's a thing called the Glasgow Fortnight. Or the Glasgow Week. Oh man, I've lost a bit of my cultural heritage. I think it was a Glasgow fortnight, where people from Glasgow would come all the 35 right. miles or whatever,
like
it is.
Like going to Blackpool from Manchester and
yes,
Liverpool
exactly.
and all that.
I suppose a little bit reminiscent of Blackpool as far as the combination of sand and water is concerned, but not as built up, not as and certainly not as many fruit machines and all that kind of stuff. Yeah,
so are you a little boy in your shorts with a bucket and spade on the beach? Was the beach part of... life, or I mean,
yeah, and so
forgive
I
forgive my sudden prejudice, but I'd imagine it's quite nippy up there, even in the
generally speaking, about a degree colder.
Oh, only one,
yeah.
So, does the beach mean anything to
yes,
you?
Yes, absolutely. I feel bereft if I don't go to the seaside every now and then. So yes, I lived maybe a 3 or 4 minute cycle ride from the beach. Dogs being walked down the beach, spending summer absolutely getting sand in your sandwiches, having liaisons with young ladies in the tall grass, the whole and then you get older and then you're going down there because you're hiding away from people so you can drink alcohol or whatever.
All the benefits that a beach has to offer.
So yeah, but on the other hand, so I would come out of my house and I would turn right and I'd go down towards the seaside, but you turn left into town, and that was... It was also quite a vibrant town. But smaller,
so it was quite
smaller,
busy. It was quite stimulating, this place. I mean, because the big question, obviously, is how does a man from the west coast of Scotland end up as far down south of England as you
yes.
can possibly imagine?
My oldest sister, Gail, and I talk about that quite a lot. So I'm the youngest and Gail's the oldest. And Gail went as far east as she could. So she lives in Edinburgh and I ended up being south. So I was the youngest. All my sisters were very clever and sporty and head girls
how
and
much
stuff.
Younger are you than what's the pecking
me be? Then Lorna 4 years older than me, then Elaine I think 3 years older than Lorna, and then Gail 3 or 4 years older than Elaine, so maybe 3 or 4 years between.
So she's
all.
Quite a sophisticated teenager by the time you're a
Gail
boy.
Gail had left home before I was 11. Yeah, Lorna and I spend most of the time together. Elaine went away to university and then came back to do a postgraduate degree and so lived at home, so I got to know her better then. But the question is, how do you get so far south?
Well, the question is, was there a drive to get out?
No,
because
not
the way
all.
You're describing it, you sound like you have great affection for the place. It wasn't the small town boy, I am so, you know, crushed, I must get out of here.
Catherine, I didn't even think about stuff enough in that. I just kind of bumble along.
Yeah.
So I had got through school all right. Didn't do particularly well academically, but kind of did okay. Had signed up to do a BA in public administration in Aberdeen University.
Right.
I can't even remember applying for that. I've no idea why or how. And I had the letter arrive saying that we've now accepted you to do this course. And I looked at this letter and said, I don't want to go
what
to Aberdeen.
What the hell is that all about?
My oldest sister, Gail, by this point was a drama teacher.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And also I should tell you that my mum had done a correspondence course with the Guildhall School of Music and Drama and become a speech and drama teacher, dealing with people who had a job interview, but also on a Saturday morning just thousands of kids coming in and out of the house. So I'd done a lot of poetry competitions, a lot of Burns competitions.
Was the theatre in did you go to the theatre?
No, I hadn't really been to a lot of that. You'd go and see stuff. And my mum had, before she did this correspondence course, had been a semi-professional actress, done some radio plays and stuff like that.
Oh, that's interesting.
But I'd done a lot of kind of performing, a lot of talking out loud in front of people.
Yeah.
And my sister Gail suggested I did this 1 year foundation drama course in Edinburgh, because the idea being, well, you do a foundation course, maybe you'll be a director, maybe you'll be a lighting designer.
Well, and the idea of a foundation, which is sort of melted away to nothing, that you could go sort of towards this and then find out what you got there, which direction it was going to take.
And so I applied for a course, And I went and did my audition. And they said, "You don't want to come to this course?" And I said, "No, I do want to come to this course." And they said, "Well, we've got a community theatre arts course that we run alongside this straight acting course. That's what you want to do." And I said, "Okay."
Okay, then. What was it? Can you remember what it was they said? This is not the hole for you, Mr. Pegg?
They just told me that I did not want to, and that I should apply for this course. Because
they were right.
Because you were getting, and they were, do you know what? They were absolutely right.
Yeah.
So I go up to Edinburgh, do this 1 year course. Just suddenly you just feel that you're in the right place, doing the right thing. People saying that you're good at what you're doing.
And did you get involved in the festival and all that? Did you?
No, we just did wee performances and workshops and
where at the what's the theatre called?
We're in a place called Theatre Workshop in Stockbridge. So this is 1985, mm-hmm. I guess. So just at that point where Scottish theatre is raising its head, 1984.
And the idea of community theatre and theatre education and all that.
Miners' strike. And while I was there, so you get about halfway through, and then you go, bugger, this is going to finish in 6 months. What am I going to do then? And I did a work placement at Theatre Workshop in Stockbridge, this marvellous vegan place. Brilliant, though. And I met a woman called Eva, who was from Germany. And she was maybe about my age, maybe a little bit older. She felt like she was more mature, certainly. So I'm 17. And she's applied to this place called Rose Bruford in London to do their community theatre arts course. And I thought, all right, I'll do that then.
Do a bit of that,
and
then.
So I applied to there.
Were you in love with Eva? Were you going to get to kiss Eva if you went to the Rose Bruford course?
But that wasn't the intention.
No.
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 No. She was lovely, though. Don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
She was a vegetarian. I wasn't a vegetarian in those days. She was proper community theatre arts. She wore leg warmers and stuff. I was still in my Dr. Martin boots.
Still are.
And I did apply to Royal Scottish Academy and stupid places like that, but they just kind of laughed at me when I came in. But I went down.
So had you been up and down to? Was going to London a regular thing in your life?
No, the only time I had been to London, I was supposed to go over the school once, and they wouldn't take me because I was asthmatic. And then my sister Lorna, who was in the Girl Guides, was singing in the Royal Albert Hall.
Of course she was. Rah, rah, the Girl Guides.
2 years later, ish. And we went down, and do you know what happened? I had the hugest asthmatic attack that you've ever.
Oh, no!
I had to get the doctor to the hotel and everything. So whoever made the decision in the school not to take me was absolutely right.
Yeah, seemed a little harsh, but
Stephen Muirhead, who was diabetic, and I weren't allowed to go. We had to go to the other primary 7. So I'd been down to see my sister Lorna, but
vaguely you weren't. It wasn't.
No, and
where is Rose Bruford?
It was based in Sidcup. But I tried very hard to find a community theatre arts course in Scotland, and it didn't exist.
Right.
That kind of BA thing didn't exist. So I thought I was doing this brilliant thing, going down to London. I went and did the audition. So I had gone from medium-sized Scottish town where everybody was white. Some class differentiation, but generally
you pretty much know each other.
Yeah, absolutely.
Of an age group,
and,
I guess.
And I have no halls of residence or anything like that, so I end up in a house in Catford with people who I still am friends with now. Facebook friends. So I'm still in touch with the people that I shared
That's
a house
nice.
With. Yeah, and they kind of dropped me off, stayed the night, and then left. And I'm wide-eyed with, you know, black faces around me and real poverty.
Well, not Scottish people.
Just all that stuff. Cockerneys. and all that stuff. So it was and then arrived at this course, which turned out to be the hardcore Trotskyist political. Man, we went on strike every week about something, and the politics of language and
gender hugely.
Conversations about, but it was mostly around colour, I suppose, around ethnic diversity. You know, the raging debates about whether blackboard was an appropriate term.
Oh, right, yes.
You know, and I could very much see the negative aspects of the word black with blackmail and black spot and all that stuff. But I was still sitting there with no voice, no ability to say, it is a board and it is black. Can we not just call it a blackboard? Why do we, you know, and... But absolutely stretched.
Were there, and you were open, and you were vocal, and you were participating in this thing. You weren't daunted by it.
No, I found my voice over a period of time, and I was very lucky that I was Scottish.
Okay, that's fine. That's red, and we're recording again. Yes, there we are. Okay. So you were at Rose Bruford.
Yeah, learning about life really
quickly. And
you're
loving it. Are you out performing? Because this is a community theatre course.
Yes.
Have they got you out in the community doing things?
Yes, a lot of that, very based on devising. I didn't even know any of this stuff before I arrived. You just, and so you learn to be quiet for the first couple of weeks, and then you get, I've worked out what was going on. And so, so we're doing stuff all the time. It's all very blocks of... bits of work, and so you learn a bit about Brecht and a lot of devising and movement and dance and singing, and completely practical. I had to write a 1,000-word dissertation at the very end, but everything else
and that was all the written that there was.
There was the people who were constantly being threatened to be kicked out, and then there was the people who were high flyers who were going to work forever and it was going to be marvellous, and then there was me. I just turned up every day and did stuff, but also you're very much encouraged to, so I was in my first band at that point.
I didn't know that. What were they called?
Elvis Presley and the Beatles. And we mostly did Johnny Cash covers. And then we also did some street theatre. I was in a street theatre act called the Flying Fellatio Brothers, which was, we went to Edinburgh, and we could do a podcast all about that brilliance.
Prancing about in Covent Garden? Were you one of those?
Yes, we did. We entered the Covent Garden Street Theatre competition. We entered the comedy section, but they had too many people entered in the comedy section, so they put us in the acrobatic section. We did do acrobatics. We did forward rolls. Mostly juggling and forward rolls, but of course,
I wonder if I saw you, because I lived in London at this time and would often walk through a Covent Garden, and you'd stop and you'd watch, and there were a few acts there that then sort of went on, and you saw them on telly and that sort of thing. So I wonder if I
it was brilliant.
I ever saw you.
We were clever, and actually, I was reflecting on this later when we were talking about the ukulele jam at Llama Tree, which was very street theatre actually.
The festival, you mean?
So, and I realised that when we were performing at Llama Tree, I was remembering back 20, 30 years ago when I was doing the street theatre semi-professionally. We didn't do that much, but certainly we did a lot of performances. I realised that there were skills that I learned then that I was
undoubtedly
utilizing.
That's the other bit of the success, big fish in a small ukulele pond, of the jam, is that the skills that people accidentally brought to the thing. One is your crowd rabble rousing things, and I think sometimes I wonder if it is a burden to carry. You know, because people just go, all right, Colin will do that.
Yeah,
Colin does that. And then people say, oh, don't tell that joke again. And you think, well, you tell a joke then. And also that we had singers.
Yeah.
And it's always struck me when I've seen other sort of community-based groups, not the pros, not the, you know, Ukulele Orchestra of Great Britain and Ireland Street, but when I've seen the other sort of community-based ukulele groups around, you think, God, we can sing, can't we?
Yeah, absolutely.
And you lot can't sing. Or, you know, not in a sort of very performance-y sort of way.
Yeah, and there, of course, we live in a great big melting pot, Catherine, right? And so there's space.
What we need.
Space for everybody.
Are you
but
an onion?
I think that what I like about the jam, and I am very conflicted about that thing that you described about me being up front and that stuff.
Oh, going, he could do that.
And so on
so
one
we'll
hand,
let him do it.
I love it. And I get, you know, I've got a big ego and I really like doing all that stuff. Which is why I'm only playing one in every three chords, because I'm trying to see what I'm going to laugh about next. But then I worry that sometimes that then you know, becomes the call-in show rather than the ukulele jam show and stuff. So I do get conflicted about it. And what I'm really liking at the moment is that there are, and, but I also feel conflicted about it, there are other people who are coming up and starting to, and so I won't do some gigs either because I can't or because I think that I should be letting somebody else do it. And so that's a negotiation that's happening around those performances.
I had a little bit of that the other day when this jam too, or the jam has spread, or I don't know what the picture is to paint, but there's this Wednesday session.
And that was really weird as well.
It's stickiness.
So Paul, who's running that thing, I think it's in the Junction Inn.
That's right.
It sent me an email. It said, is it all right if And I'm going, no, this isn't, it's not. But I can see why other people think that it is. And to a degree, sometimes I even feel it. But what I want it to be is nothing. It's not anyone's decision. You can go and do anything else. In the same way as, on Friday, we were offered to go to the radio, so I picked a couple of people just to do it. Now, perhaps I should have asked everybody and done a poll and worked, but there's no time for all that. So I think that I try and live by the fact that there aren't any rules.
It's been a brilliant thing that kind of... it's not anarchy, is it? But that sort of... I remember somebody wrote chaos some words. Theory. Yeah, the chaos of it all. Somebody, who I won't name, wrote some words once about how, the Southampton Ukulele Jam is a democracy. And I thought, no, it isn't.
No.
Nobody ever votes about anything.
No.
There's no sense of here are the structures within which you have your voice. We're making it all sound terribly serious. But you know, there's sensitivities and egos, and some people play better than others, and some people have got louder voices than others, and some people come because they want to get away from their kids for a night, and some people come because they're trying to build a career in the music business, or whatever it is, and it has managed to be there for all those people.
And I, people will come up to me and say, I never thought I'd be in a gigging band. I can't believe I've just done that, and all those things make me feel very proud of what we started off, and sometimes it's the worst thing in the world. It is a monster, and sometimes I find it really hard, and then other times, like now, it's really
It's just joyful and
So
going to finish your story. So you get to the end of your degree. You've done well.
Yes.
Have a certificate, Colin.
Yes.
Have a 2-1-2-0.
It was a diploma that was, while I was there, accredited as a BA. So I've kind of got somewhere in between a diploma and a BA. If I ever wanted to do a teacher training, I've got enough of a BA to mean that I've got a degree.
Yeah. But I think at our age, they don't really bother about that sort of stuff anymore. Yeah, I haven't got one.
So what I've done is I tried to find a community theatre arts course in Scotland, couldn't find one. So I'm now going to return like a triumphant hero, having done a community theatre arts course, to Scotland to...
Where you were going to bring theatres of other people.
No, I was just going to take the skills that I'd learned and join these community theatre companies.
Okay, yeah.
So I write to them all, including Theatre Workshop that I'd done some work experience with, and was told on the telephone, but you trained in England. And I said, I couldn't find a course in Scotland like it. No way you can get a job in England now. I genuinely had backs turned against me.
What's that? That's because you're too big for your boots now, or you don't...
No, you've become English.
Oh, how interesting.
I think.
Yeah. That's what you took from it, anyway.
I tried to get work in Scotland and couldn't. By this point, I'm in a long-term relationship with my partner. She was in the year above me, so she has left and is working. And then I finish.
Working, performing, working.
Yeah. And we've got a house in Plumstead, and I'm trying to get work, and it's not going particularly well.
So what you do, behind the stage every Thursday, and in the back and all that.
Yeah, and writing a million letters and all that stuff. This is before mobile telephones.
No internet, folks.
Nothing like that. And then the people who owned the house that we were renting hadn't been paying their mortgage, and so the house is being repossessed, and so we now are faced with some difficult decisions. And so we decide to up sticks and move to Edinburgh.
How did that happen?
So we're in the process of moving, and that's all happening, and I get a phone call from a woman called Helen, who was a friend of a friend of mine called Graham to say that there was a company in Southampton who were looking for somebody to devise some music for a play that they were about to do. It's a 3-month contract. So we
can you remember what the play was?
I might in a minute.
Go on. Yeah.
Okay, I had no idea. So we moved to Edinburgh, but I then get a
and
job.
And you then got the job.
So it's going to be a 3-month job. So it's going to be a three-month job. Yes, yes, and
that was Solent People's Theatre, and that was
Hampshire Theatre in Education.
Hampshire TIE. Yes, yes, yes.
And the guy who was the director, Chris Baldwin, was he had done some work at Rose Bruford. So I turned up for the interview, for the audition, to play music. I didn't have any musical skills. I've already told you that 30 years later, I've still not got any. But I'm going to devise this soundscape. And I just...
I think you should do it now.
And he goes, well, you survived Rose Bruford. You can survive 3 months here. That's all right for me. It'll be fine. So I moved to Southampton just for 3 months. Very quickly in the rehearsal process, convinced everyone that it wasn't a soundscape that we needed; it was another performer.
And so,
not even willfully. Just that's just what happened.
That'll be his charisma.
And I ended up staying there for 5 years. So I was off to the next contract and the next contract.
So you had to get on the phone, to the missus and say,
Yeah, but I spent maybe a year, so she got a job. Eventually, you know, I'm very settled in this company, so we moved to West Totton. But by this point, Karen's pregnant with my son, Jack, who's now 21, so this is 21 odd years ago. And we've now stopped just being a little theatre and education company in Hampshire and are working all across Europe doing youth theatre projects and all sorts of stuff, travelling all over the place. We became pregnant, and so we moved to West Totton. And nothing against West Totton, but
boy,
that was a culture. People mowing their grass on a Sunday morning.
Yeah.
I'm 24.
You were very badly, poorly advised by.
It was the only place we could get a house, and it was cheap enough. But suddenly, from having a relationship where we had. You know, it had always been a holiday. She'd been working, and so we'd meet up for weekends and stuff. Suddenly, we're in West Totton with a baby. I moved to Fremantle eventually, and this is between Karen and I.
Yeah, this is real life. This
relationship just imploded. I guess that sounds very dramatic. It just, from my perspective, Karen's got a whole perspective of her own, I'm sure. But we just, between us, I certainly couldn't handle it anymore, and so we split up. Which was really difficult because Jack was only little, and but by this point I'm settled in Southampton, and then so the Spinoff Theatre Company was based around the director Chris Baldwin, me, and a stage manager called Dawn Dyson, and then various other people who would come in and out, and one day, certainly my memory will tell me, that we all came into a team meeting and all of us almost in the same breath said, I've had enough, I need to do something else now.
Right.
And so the company kind of, by this point, was part of the Nuffield Theatre, and it got absorbed a bit more and has gone off and done other things, and we all went off and did our different things.
Right.
Did a performance in the Nuffield Theatre, got an agent. By the end of what I would regard as my acting career, I was doing a lot of adverts, which was funding a few small-scale theatre projects. I'm Nana the dog in Peter Pan, not in the theatre.
Did you have a full skin? And what was the costume?
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Oh,
that's steamy. I bet it was stinky in there.
It was absolutely stinky.
Yeah.
There's a weird thing.
I have been a wardrobe mistress in my life. I've looked after these things.
It still exists.
Oh, how revolting.
The costume. And it needs to be put down. Recently, 5 years ago, Robbie did a backstage tour, and there's a photograph of him wearing the hat, wearing the thing. It was absolutely full skin, and I had a relationship with Tinkerbell, and she became pregnant.
And you made a Tinker baby.
And we made a Tinker baby,
who's now
16 years ago. And then I met the current Mrs. McAllister, Sarah, who's got a boy, Jake, and we ultimately get married and have a boy, Robbie. So we've got these 4 children between us. And I'm now so settled in Southampton, but I'm getting a bit Have I had Robbie by this point? I can't remember. I'm certainly very frustrated about pointing at furniture and saying 799 and 699, because I was doing a lot of adverts and not much else, and had been to the Rose Bruford to change the world.
Yeah, so it wasn't really doing.
And a friend of mine,
proper acting, as my family would probably call it.
No, yeah, absolutely. And a friend of mine, Kat, there suggested I worked in a drug and alcohol detox, and I thought that was an awful idea. But my mum had died, and her voice was ringing in my ears saying, "You're not allowed to say, I don't want to do it until you've tried it."
Ah,
so I went and did.
Wise woman.
Yeah. I went and did a shadow shift.
And you took to it?
Yeah. And so I then became a drug and alcohol worker.
A totally unqualified drug and alcohol worker, yeah, to begin with.
Completely. I was able to double sign a med sheet and cook a breakfast, which is what you needed to be able to do in a,
right,
in a detox at that point, and then did every course that was offered to me. It's far more regulated now. I kind of just arrived at the point where you could kind of come in with a winning smile.
Yeah, I kind of couldn't imagine that at all.
And then just worked across this sector in a variety of different places. Still did a bit of acting for a while. I was just on the bank for a while, and then they offered me a full-time job, and I thought, well, I'll do it for a couple of years because I quite like it. And I've never stopped. And it wasn't until, just to try and complete a circle, it wasn't really until 2008, by which point Robbie, my youngest boy, is 8, because he was born in 2000. Yeah. And Jake is, by this point, wherever he is, 11, 12. And so 13, we're just getting to the stage in our family where
you're out of nappies and you're...
Yeah, and eventually Jake and Jack, who's even older, is able to babysit. And so suddenly
it's great, that bed, isn't it? When the older ones can look after.
And then I'm suddenly in a band, and we're from the first night doing performances. And so I start to remember my performance kick and how much I like that. And so that kind of reignited my performing aspect, not earning any money from it, but my performing world. And then the Spiral Tones, which is a band that I'm in, kind of formed through that. And then reintroduced to Deborah Gearing and various other actory, writery kind of people. Mm-hmm. And so I now live in a brilliant world where, you know, I do my day job commissioning and coordinating drug services, but I also get to perform and devise or work with writers or sing songs or go to Lavatory Music Festival. And so I feel very fortunate that I've got all these.
And your wife, in the meantime, has had a whole other change. Because when I first met you, Sarah was, and we'll talk to Sarah about this in her own right, obviously, but it's been very interesting to me that you've, the hindsight of our friendship, I can see that you've both been through this massive transitional time where she, who is a veterinary surgeon by training, when I first met you, I had no idea she was a vet.
Oh, really?
And no, she was a fine arts student. That's all I knew. So I kind of guessed that obviously this is a second career from something, but what that was from. And Sarah is a fascinating character. Her story of her life in Australia as a young woman, and then coming out on her own very early, being fiercely intellectually gifted, which I don't think sometimes she understands exactly how incredibly brilliant she is. Part of that, when she's frowning, and it's only because you're very clever, Sarah. We're all trying to keep up with you.
It's true, you're terrifying.
But so that you know, she was doing a fine art degree, which I know she cares passionately about and carries on working very diligently to try and practice as an artist now. And so many people don't actually manage to do that after they come out. Even mature students don't manage to do that.
Can we just track back? So when we first got together, I was a jobbing actor and she had a proper job. And then somehow, without me actually willfully being part of this decision, I've got a bloody proper job and she's an artist.
And she's...
How did that happen?
Banging about taking pictures of dead things.
So, yeah, I don't quite know how that worked out.
It's a beautiful thing.
But weirdly now, I think we both surf both those ways. So she also does still work as a veterinary surgeon whilst doing her art practice and also working as a lecturer at Solent.
I've forgotten that bit.
And so I don't earn any money from my performing things, but I manage to juggle having a proper job, but also have all these brilliant opportunities, some of which absolutely cross over with what she's doing. So suddenly I'm part of an artistic community of people that includes
you, that's true.
That includes Sarah and all her compadres, that includes Deborah Gearing, and I met Annie McKean from Winchester.
Well, and you look at people like Vix Hobbs and Grant Sharkey.
Yeah.
And Pete Harvey, who I sometimes stand up alongside on stage where he's playing bass and I'm ukulele, and we look at each other, and what we're saying to each other is, how the fuck did we get here? It's really interesting hearing this story of your path, because you arrived in Southampton. I don't think I'd really sort of focused on the dates, but we've been here the whole time
1990.
Together.
I arrived in 1990.
We've been here together, and yet our paths never crossed until the little four-string wonder.
Yeah.
Brought us together.
Yeah, 1990, I moved to Southampton. And all those things have happened. And then we end up, you know, in the rain this afternoon, putting ribbon on a hoarding. With Alex, who plays with
Alex Dunlop
Jam as well. And so he's...
And again, he's been in Southampton much longer than anybody knew. Because he's from Northern Ireland, I think, I certainly didn't, I think lots of people assumed that him and his partner Dawn had just arrived from maybe from Northern Ireland, or they've talked about Birmingham. No, they've been here forever.
But they've also had a young child who's now, Imogen, who's now, getting to an older age. And so I think that there is something, certainly in my experience, that your world kind of opened back up again after what felt like decades of kids.
What have I done?
Suddenly, you're all these opportunities, and Alex is a really interesting person to talk to. I find it quite difficult sometimes because he suggests, and I think he's right, that joining the ukulele jam, so I met him in Portsmouth during the Pompalele thing, and then he turned up at the ukulele jam and has become a really close friend of mine, and he will talk that he felt, and I think it's related to having a young child, very insular, and then suddenly the ukulele jam, suddenly you've got access to people and ideas. And if you keep your eyes open and your ears open, suddenly you're, at Katie Martin and doing a radio show.
Yes, you're on the BBC,
You're at Lamatry Music Festival, or you're, I'm going to Medium Secure Mental Health Unit on Friday with the lovely Uncle Julian Harrow. And, what brilliant opportunities to see, get inside other places and have all these fantastic experiences. Yeah, so Sarah's got an incredibly intelligent brain, and I've got no shame. That's my skill. She can analyse her way out of a problem, and I can balls out a problem. It'll be all right.
It's a hot combination.
And so I think that between us, we've got a good way forward.
Well, I'm fabulously lucky that, as well as the ukulele bringing me you as a friend, it also brought me Sarah as a friend in her own right, which has been a delight in my life. Anyway. What do you want to plug? What's going on that you want people to come and see?
Okay, yes. So on December the 22nd is Southampton Ukulele Jam's 6th Christmas Cabaret, Talking Heads Pub. Doors open at 7. Fun starts at 7:30. So this is the 6th year that I've kind of taken a lead in organising it, and I am lucky enough that I get everyone to email me and tell me what they're going to do, and no one else knows.
Oh, that's true. You know all the secrets.
And so
but you don't actually know what we're doing, do you?
I don't know what you're doing, no. Yeah, of all the years, there is going to be some absolute beautiful things, and also some chaos, some absolute chaos. So that's the 22nd. It's £5 if you have a job, £4 if you're not. It's in aid of Macmillan Cancer Support, and a marvellous thing called Saints for Sports, which is a charitable thing run between Southampton Football Club and a thing called the Society St James, which is a company I used to work for, charity I used to work for, who work with people with mental health problems, homelessness and substance misuse problems. And Southampton Football Club, people really getting a lot out of it. So I'm really pleased that we're supporting that, as well as Macmillan Cancer Support, kind of with a nod to my beautiful mother-in-law, Mo, and various other people.
So that's that. But then your own band, The Spiral Tones, are playing.
That's right. On a week later, on the 29th of December. Thanks for that heads up. This is related to my oldest boy, Jack, who we talked about earlier. He's got a friend called Dan, who is a promoter, Amalfi Sessions, I think they're called. And there's a night of various different musical treats, which will be kicked off with my band, The Spiral Tones.
Brilliant. So you're going to be the
openers.
The dad band.
Yeah.
Oh, you're very much the support act.
Yeah, we're just kicking it off.
Cool.
And featuring my lovely oldest boy, Jack, is going to be performing there with his friend Lana. They call themselves All of You Cowboys, I think is their current name. Some beautiful music there. So yeah, it'd be cracking.
Colin McAllister, I cannot thank you enough for this lovely conversation.
Well done on that.
So there we go. If you want your children to grow up to be super cool and have great haircuts, you could do a lot worse than take some lessons in life from the story of my dear buddy Colin McAllister. Isn't he a sweetie? Now, normally I would hope to be able to tell you who's going to be on the podcast next week, but I haven't got that confirmed yet. Still getting all that in place. But if you like conversations, real conversations with real people who are not trying to sell you anything, but I've just got interesting stories to tell, then you can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. Please tell your friends, because in that way we can get more people listening. You can follow the show on Twitter at NoBitsPod, or go to NoBitsPod.com, where you can listen to the podcast. You can also see pictures and links to some of the things that I've talked about, including to the ukulele jam, which, yes, anybody is welcome to join if they wish. So that's about it, my darlings. Take it easy, keep dry, it's hammering down here, and I'll talk to you next week. Bye.